Our story begins in the busy streets of Havana, Cuba, the 1980s. The food system is dependent on industrial agriculture and imports. 1989. The oil crisis means an end of oil and food coming in from Russia. The country faces a massive food shortage. Desperation. Starving people do the only thing they can to stay alive. They start growing their own food. Everywhere. On balconies, empty lots, backyards, terraces. Anything. Completely organic. Fruit, beans, potatoes, pigs, goats. Anywhere and everywhere is a place for food. In 2 years, gardens and farms are in every neighborhood in Havana. The government starts to take notice. But instead of quashing the efforts, they start to help out. 1994, the Cuban government opens an urban agriculture department. They don't just make it legal, they make it free, turning unused public land into gardens to grow food. Then, they train an army of people to monitor and help out the gardeners. They set up seed houses, community hubs with resources and information for neighborhood gardeners. And finally, they set up market space for farmers to gather and sell their produce. By 1998, there are over 8,000 organic gardens, run by individual growers and by the state. That's about half of all the country's vegetables. Sure, Cuba's different than here in Canada. The politics is different. The state has a lot more control. Lots of North American cities don't own that much land. Still, there are plenty of parallels.
From market to marketing, our relationship with food is shifting. The corporatization of our food system is making the way we eat unsustainable. There's a need and a demand to bring us closer to our food. Just like in Cuba, a lot of this shift starts with people. In this episode, we explore stories of urban agriculture, of everyday people taking initiative, their challenges and their successes, of the small scale and the large, of building community and feeding our neighborhoods, of doing good business and making our cities beautiful. Instead of cities guiding our agriculture, we may have to learn how to let agriculture guide our cities. Now there's some food for thought. In this episode, we explore agriculturing the city.
I'm Ross Soward.
And I'm Danielle Davis.
And this is Cities Alive, bringing the city to life with stories.
That's Nosy. She acts as a rooster. She's a hen. She's very nosy, hence her name, Nosy.
City government plays a key role in what happens and doesn't happen within municipal boundaries. Urban agriculture is no exception, from chickens to farmers markets.
Typically in a flock of chickens, when a male rooster is absent long enough, the alpha female will start to exhibit behaviors of a rooster.
It may seem like small beans, but backyard chickens are part of a bigger picture: food security. At its heart, food security is all about being able to feed ourselves, having ready access to nutritious food. But food security is also connected to how much control we have over our food, whether we can produce, distribute, and consume it. So what role do cities have in food security?
Victoria's only limit is there's no roosters allowed. Very few complaints. I mean, when you talk to the animal control staff here, maybe it's something that municipalities are trying to regulate that maybe doesn't need to be regulated.
What does food security look like?
It was a little out of control.
I had a greenhouse, I had cold frames, I had 12 kinds of fruit trees, blackberry vines, raspberries, everything. You know, and people have been complimenting me on how pretty it is, and then they suddenly go, oh, that's food.
What does food security feel like?
It's almost as good as having a cottage, I think. Having somewhere that you can get away from everything, anytime, you know, night or day, is absolutely wonderful. And growing your own stuff, of course, is unparalleled. It's wonderful.
And what does food security sound like? Many urban planners don't see what they do as connected to food security.
Back in 2006, maybe earlier, some academics did a survey of planners in the United States to see how much they knew about their role in the food system, and only 30% of planners saw a role for themselves.
That's Karen Landman. She's one of Canada's leading experts in urban agriculture.
We decided we'd do a survey of Ontario planners, see what they thought. We thought, well, we can do better than that. And we were abysmally lower. We were at 15% of planners saw themselves as having a role.
Ontario planners are hardly alone. Many planners consider Victoria, BC, as a leader in food security. Their official community plan has a whole chapter on the topic. But even the West Coast's so-called City of Gardens is having a hard time figuring out its role when it comes to food security. One of Victoria's community planners, Christina Burris, describes the challenge.
We're already pretty dense. We have nowhere near the land base that you would need to be able to be self-sufficient.
Food security is an official city goal, on the books. But without clear direction from the public, that priority risks being bumped off the agenda at City Hall. Without the community pushing for innovation, the city lacks direction.
Victoria's approach has definitely been to say, yeah, you know, maybe we'll consider that. But then to wait for the private sector or community groups to approach us to actually do some of those projects. We're not actively taking the lead.
But sometimes, even when the public speaks up, cities just aren't listening. And when they don't, it's a missed opportunity. Jean Snow lives on Canada's East Coast. She approached city staff in Halifax a few years ago with an unusual request.
We said, you know, we want to be more involved in our own food and be less dependent on the grocery stores. And I literally read the book at the end of May. We started our garden June 9th, and we were at the farmer's market by July 4th.
Jean and her husband Bob launched Lake City Farm in 2008, right in their own backyard.
So we had a refrigerator on our deck, and we bought some of the equipment that they recommend. And we ended up having to call the food bank a couple of times. We just were amazed at how much food we could grow. And it was just our own yard, just our backyard. So we said, okay, let's go to the next step. And the next step was to build a walk-in cooler. And then we used it really well with our CSAs. The customers, we didn't even have to be here. The customers would come in, go and get their stuff out of the shed.
Yeah.
They'd go in there, find their name, and grab their stuff and go.
Next, Jean and Bob started satellite plots in other people's backyards, first in some group homes, then in other homes in their neighborhood. It took off, all by word of mouth.
As it got bigger and there's more people joining in, some people wanted to be part of it, and some people wanted to learn, some people wanted to, you know, have a couple rows themselves. We actually put gardens in for people where they owned it, but each year it got bigger and bigger.
Pretty soon, Jean had more business than she could handle. She was a full-time urban farmer. She had to hire an apprentice to keep up with demand. Backyards that were vacant before were becoming small-scale intensive gardens. Pretty soon, though, the city caught wind, and Lake City Farm hit a wall.
the bylaw that I'm infringing on, I guess, is that I'm not allowed to grow food on other people's property, and I'm not allowed to sell my food outside my house. And I do both those things.
To grow food, you need land. And in a city, that might mean borrowing someone else's. City zoning and land use policies were holding her back.
As a home business, as an urban farmer, I should be able to grow my food wherever I need to and then take that food wherever I need to, whether it's to sell it at the house that I grew it at or to take it to the farmer's market or to bring it home and mix it all up with other produce that I've grown other places and make a CSA, whatever. I need to be able to do that anywhere.
We call those folks aggregators.
That's Karen again.
And what they're doing is not just selling their own food, but other people's food as well. And it, you know, if I'm a grower, I don't necessarily want to be the distributor as well. So if there's somebody else that I can work with who will help distribute my product, then it gives me more time to grow. If you have people who are aggregators, whether they're, you know, small scale or large scale, it can be a real benefit to a lot of people and to the consumer, because then they have a real range of products that they can buy as well.
A major step forward for food security in Halifax has become a wasted opportunity. But this isn't the case everywhere. Karen again.
We're seeing more people who are considering themselves to be farmers and to be productive farmers and make a living as an entrepreneur in the urban environment. When you were young, you were the king of colored flowers, and how you built a tower tumbling through the trees in holy rattlesnakes that fell all around your feet.
Urban agriculture, it's not just fringe. As we see from Lake City Farms, it can actually be good business. Elsewhere in Canada, a wave of pioneers are finding creative ways to make urban food production work, sometimes in unlikely places.
So we, you know, hit Google Maps and just started looking around, and eventually we stumbled across this. And the building owners were really amenable to the idea, and the building was really kind of perfect. We're just regular tenants in the building. maybe not so regular, but.
Lufa Farms is hardly what you'd consider a regular tenant. Still, things are looking up for this Montreal company. If you explore the streets of Montreal, though, you'd probably have a hard time spotting this new brand of urban farm.
In 2010, 2011, we built the world's first commercial rooftop greenhouse. So that's a 30,000 square foot greenhouse just on an industrial building in a northern neighborhood of Montreal. We have a full-scale rooftop greenhouse, and we grow about 40 different varieties of vegetables year-round. So we have tomatoes and cucumbers and eggplant and peppers and you name it.
Since getting its start 4 years ago, Lufa has been wildly successful.
So last year we harvested 70.5 metric tons of produce from the greenhouse.
That's equivalent to more than 80 Volkswagen Beetles in weight per year.
The kind of idea behind it is that we grow food where people live and we grow it more sustainably. So we do it using no new land, basically growing right where our customers live. We use no synthetic pesticides, herbicides, or fungicides. We just deploy biological controls. We grow hydroponically, so we recirculate 100% of our irrigation water, and that cuts down on water use costs by something like 90%. Because we're on top of the building, we use about half the energy heat. And then we harvest at 5 o'clock in the morning and deliver to our customers in the afternoon.
And as the business expands, it creates jobs for a new generation of farmers. Farmers who can take the subway to work.
Yeah, it's been really, really astounding, the response we've gotten since we launched our first greenhouse. So we had about 400 initial subscribers when we launched in April 2011. Now we're up to about 2,500 subscribers in Montreal. We have the second greenhouse going up, which is about a third larger. And we're looking at a bunch of new cities and much larger greenhouses and things like that.
But it didn't just happen. Lufa had to figure out how to make their farm work in a city planning framework that had never dealt with this kind of large-scale commercial rooftop garden.
The primary kind of challenges that we came across were zoning restrictions. Obviously, a lot of these areas aren't zoned for agriculture. They're zoned for industrial or residential or things like that. So really allowing for that variance was kind of one of the main challenges we've been running into. But a lot of cities, you know, since we started this process in full force in 2009, a lot of cities have started realizing that this is a great way to make their cities self-sufficient in food production. And I know that New York, for instance, has introduced a slew of new legislation to allow for this sort of use, and other cities are following suit. Doing it on a commercial scale and doing it, you know, on such a large scale and as a business, that definitely sets a precedent for allowing this sort of use and for amending building codes and zoning restrictions to allow for this sort of use.
Lufa's broken ground globally with a new kind of farming business, making change from both the bottom up and the top down to bring our food system closer to home. What's more, it's making on-the-ground connections between people as producers and the city as regulators. They're just one successful example of what can happen when communities and cities collaborate.
It's interesting how you try to reach people who are, say, you know, at the top level, who are writing policy and so on in municipalities, and then at the grassroots level as well. So these people, trying to get them to connect with each other can be a pretty powerful way to move this along pretty quickly.
Often, it starts with one person.
Chica.
Okay, my name is Cheryl Coleman, and I coordinate the Transitional Housing Program with Choices for Youth. I also have someone else here with me.
My name is Peter Boland. I'm an active participant in some of the Choices programs here in St. John's.
I don't need no ham and eggs, put the high in cholesterol.
Younger, about 5 to 6 years old, I used to be actively helping out, starting up community gardens, and then I went through a long time of a rough patch in my life where I started to get away from gardening, and now, from participating in the Choices for Youth Community Gardens, I'm getting back the skills that I lost.
Peter Boland is a resident of the Choices for Youth Transitional Housing Program in St. John's, Newfoundland. He's also the youth mastermind behind the New Leaf Community Garden. Choices for Youth is a nonprofit that supports at-risk youth. Cheryl Coleman is one of the coordinators of the Choices for Youth Garden.
About 2 years ago, our Choices for Youth had a strategic planning day with staff and young people. And one of the things that came up was the rising cost of living and how many young people can't afford to grow healthy food or can't afford to buy healthy food. And the idea of a community garden kind of grew out of that. And I guess everybody kind of became excited about the possibility of a community garden. And given Peter's skills and his expertise, he was one of the youth that we really, you know, the garden wouldn't be what it is without Peter.
They didn't just want a place to grow food. They wanted a place to bring the community to life. Everyone wanted to contribute. A neighborhood landscaper volunteered to do a lot of the work. Three major funders came on board, and the garden came to life. Tomatoes, peas, squash, a basketball court, picnic tables for people to gather. What's more, youth have been involved from day one. They're learning new skills and getting access to healthy food.
The other thing that I've noticed is that because the youth and the staff work together to plan and to care for the garden, and the workers who work with transitional housing and young people take turns watering the garden and weeding the garden, this working side by side has proven to be a means for staff and young people to connect and to build relationships, and the garden's kind of been a tool to make that happen. These relationships are key with respect to helping young people make the changes that they see as important in their lives.
Support workers and kids chat at picnic tables. Kids from the neighborhood come to play basketball. Instead of being closed off, the garden is reaching out. It's a spark that brings the neighborhood to life. Most importantly, the garden is giving people like Peter the chance to turn over a new leaf.
I'm learning valuable skills that will stick with me for a lifetime. It's like riding a bike. Once you know how to start a plant, you'll know how to do it for the rest of your life.
And there is change afoot, a culture change, on an even larger scale, moving towards better food security. And one of the big ways this is happening is through food hubs.
So there's an incredible range of the kinds of food hubs that are out there, and they're really growing exponentially.
According to Karen, food hubs are centers that deal with producing, collecting, storing, processing, distributing, and or marketing of local food. Basically, food hubs are involved in every stage of the process.
There's just such a variety of food hubs. So, for example, in the Niagara area, there's a virtual hub, if you like, where farmers can post on a website what they have and to sell that week, and then the consumer can come on at a certain point and create their own grocery list. And then they all meet in a church basement one evening a week where all that food is exchanged.
Karen says there's no cookie-cutter model. Toronto is home to one of Canada's largest food hubs. And it's not just about buying and selling local grub.
The stop in Toronto, that's very much about community development. And they evolved out of a food bank, but now they have nutrition lessons, they have a community kitchen, they have they teach kids how to cook, they have a world foods garden, they have a farmer's market. There's a lot going on there.
Karen was so enthusiastic about the stop, we wanted to follow the action for ourselves.
Yes. You follow the sound.
Yeah, I follow
you
the
follow
sound.
You follow the sound.
That's what I do. That's what happens when you're in radio.
So right now I'm looking for a scissor, so it's a special scissor to cut the roots.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. What are you going to cut?
I'm going to cut mint. I'm going to harvest mint.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what it's neem.
Okay.
Which is because this cucumber plant has a disease. So you spray it with this, and this is supposed to help.
Feel free to tell me what you're doing.
Oh, well, I'm just, I've stacked some of the, this is sort of a layer compost sort of thing.
Sorry.
A little bit of soil to keep it working.
Right.
To keep the organisms in the soil active on the vegetation that I'm laying down.
Right.
We harvested 4 beds of garlic,
equal to 596 bulbs. And that day, everyone who went to the food bank got a braid of garlic.
We've got four of our pumpkins over there.
Yeah.
They're a variety called Big Macs.
Oh, those are pumpkins?
Yeah. Come take a look.
The stop in Toronto is one example of change toward food security on a large scale. But it doesn't have to be big, and it doesn't have to be complicated. It can be as easy as planting a seed.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me.
Everyone's talking about sustainability, but nobody's really planting for it. And I thought we've got to start getting food in the ground.
Virginie Gazelle is a landscape architect based in Ontario. In 2011, she approached the Enviro group Transition Guelph with an idea.
I suggested that I could get trees wholesale and we could sell them online and start planting them in people's backyards. And the idea just took off. I had a crew of 20 within half an hour.
She called it the Tree Mobile.
We get the bare root plants delivered. That have been ordered, and then all the volunteers pack them into their various cars, which we call Tree-mobile. We made little signs and we drive around the city and planting trees. It's sort of like a bookmobile, except it's trees. At the beginning, we were still selling at the market and things like that. But finally, we figured out how to sell it online. And that just grew exponentially. So last year, I think we planted about close to 1,000 plants.
I'm in talks with the church next door, and we've started doing a little bit of a garden there. In time, I'd like to make it an orchard, but I haven't really told the church about that yet.
Moving to the country, I'm gonna eat a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country, I'm gonna eat me a lot of peaches. I'm moving to the country.
People are beginning to stand up for change, to break the boundaries. They're taking initiative and pushing for food security. Cities are starting to take notice. Some cities are even getting creative themselves, partnering with communities on public land. We talked earlier on about Victoria. A few years ago, the city decided they wanted to plant something permanent. They found a couple parks that would fit the bill. Then they reached out to the community.
The city approached two different community groups, one in the Fernwood neighborhood, which is the Fernwood NRG, and then the other was in the Vic West neighborhood, and that was the Victoria West Food Security Collective.
They weren't just looking for a few garden beds. This was for an orchard that would last a century.
Just like as if they were doing a community garden, they had to put in plans and landscape plans. They had to do a lot of work showing that there was neighborhood support for it. They had to give a description of how they'd be looked after for maintaining the trees, including pruning, as well as harvesting the fruit.
It may seem dry, but it was a big step for Victoria. The city was giving up power, which was a big deal and would have been unheard of a dozen years ago. It also heralded a big shift in city thinking on food security. Instead of talking about installing a baseball diamond or a playground, the city was talking about an orchard. And that's showing something.
The community orchards were approved in the spring of last year, and both of them were planted in the fall of this year. And they are both flourishing.
When cities and communities collaborate, there's no end to what they can achieve together.
I'm seeing more and more of that happening. It varies depending on where you are. Edmonton, a decade ago, wasn't really thinking urban agriculture at all. Now, if you go to their website, they have all kinds of policies. This fundamental shift in a couple of years, and now they're seen as one of the leaders in developing municipal policy on food systems and on urban agriculture. So it can happen pretty quickly.
Do you use them for the cafe?
We share. I'm not really allowed to talk about how we share our eggs.
Right, okay.
But we use our eggs in every way possible that I feel benefits our community.
Right. That's a good politically correct answer.
Our backyard hosts all of the kids in the neighborhood. They love interacting with the chickens, feeding the chickens. Neighbors have hosted birthday parties for their kids in our backyard because our backyard is more fun than, say, that backyard over there. So I think if people do want to go into local food production, quote, quote, they need to do it in a way that fits in with their neighborhood. And is aligned with the ethos of their community, and be respectful of the people around them to make it beautiful. I think that everything we do should be done beautifully, and that's doing food well.
Come a little bit closer, hear what I have to say.
You've been listening to Cities Alive, the podcast, bringing the city to life with stories. Cities Alive is a Planning Design Center production, created and produced by Danielle Davis, Jordan Omond, and me, Ross Soward. But there's